I'm Ross Heide, and this is the session in the week that we're going to look at giants of the Pacific Southwest. Looking at church history is kind of exciting. I'm not sure what introduction and what state, what period you came out in. Some of you may have come out right after the war, some during the war, maybe before that. Maybe some of you were born out here. Were any of you here before World War II? Were you natives of the West Coast? Okay. Where were you born? During World War II, okay?
No, I came out during the war.
During the war. You did too?
I did too.
Well.
Born in Seattle.
How about that? What part?
Oh, I see.
Well, that's interesting. Well, we're part of the war immigrants too. We came out and it'd be interesting just to share a bit of this before we go back to early history in the far west. We were sent out to the war housing area in Richmond, California, where Henry Kaiser was building ships. And there we were introduced to the mix that is really the West Coast. People from all around. And we had a delightful experience in the Richmond, California war housing area, sent to a little project of 850 homes called Harborgate. And around that were 3,000 apartments, the old two-story kind of war housing that you may have seen in different parts of the West. And we had a very interesting time. And to us, that was an experience of meeting the mix of folks from many, many states and many parts of the country who were brought out here to help build ships so that the war effort could get moving and that supplies could be transported. We had a community building as a place where we were serving, and a mix of children from many, many families, so much so that we were curious as to what their background was. And we learned that their understanding of their earlier denominational experience was not always accurate. One time as they were registering for vacation Bible school, I decided as they were coming in and putting their names down, I'd find out where they were, and I would say, where did you go to church back home before you came here? One little lad said, I went to the Baptistarian church. Another little girl said, I went to the cafeteria church. And it was really interesting the way in which they would share their names. The very best of all of them, though, was a little boy when I asked him, and he looked at me and he said, back home I went to the Episcopalian Sunday school. he was really a mix, wasn't he? But some of us will learn as you come west that there is a crossing over of denominations, and there also is a cooperation between the religious groups. Although in the very beginning out west, before there had been any other settlers, and when transportation was so limited, only by ship could they come, except for those who came up early from Mexico as a part of the Franciscans coming in to first what was Arizona. Eusebius Kino was the historic person who came up with a party and entered what is Arizona and stayed there for some 30 years. And while he was there, he was effective in starting 29 missions. And he started not only these communities, but he brought in certain kinds of grains and helped them learn how to do it and bring new vegetables, and he had a tremendous influence. He traveled thousands of miles, and under his guidance and those of the other Franciscans, he brought new strains of crops, horses, cattle, and left a tremendous impact. Some of the churches that were planted you can still see today, one of them outside of Tucson, a big white church, very beautiful and very striking. In the up the coast from San Diego, many of you have seen some of the missions that are the fruit of Father Junipero Serra and the Franciscans, who came up and wanting to have a place where they could stay at the end of a day's travel, they built a series of missions, and there were hospitality was granted to the travelers. And those missions were along the road they called the King's Highway, El Camino Real. And some of them are still there today, although some have fallen into disrepair and pretty much abandoned. But the historic value of them is undoubted. The beautiful Santa Barbara Mission is also the center of the archives for the Franciscans, and we stopped there. And the archivist opened up their vault, and I was able to see a letter written by the hand of Father Juniperus Serra. It was a rather interesting experience to see it. Now, there were different waves of immigrants that came. The dates, of course, the early mariners that came, and explorers, Cabrillo, and then Sir Francis, and then Drake, and then Captain Cook, of course, up in the Northwest. But as they came along and settled, some of us have read journals like Dana's 2 Years Before the Mast, that gives the experience of a young fellow who left college because of his health, went to sea and spent 2 years, and most of it sailing up and down the West Coast as they gathered hides from the Spanish rancheros, where they grew cattle, and then they would take the hides and then wait for those ships that would come by to get them. The Americans, of course, the early explorers were the mountain men. They came into the Rockies and then some into the Sierras. Two of them especially, Josiah Walker. Walker Lake is named after him. And then Jedediah Smith, called Bible-toting Jedediah Smith, because he always carried a Bible. And he was a very devout person. And they were the early explorers. If you've read the story of Fremont and others who were early explorers and map makers sent out by the U.S. government, some of those early experiences you know about. And you know that Monterey was a key port. Ships put in there. Not only American ships, but French ships and British ships. And it was like a chess game because the Mexicans had very few soldiers scattered around. And it was as just a kind of diplomatic game as to who was going to be able to maneuver into position. The foreign department of England was, of course, the Hudson Bay Company. And they had settlements in the Northwest and Vancouver and Astoria. And they even sent people down through the Willamette Valley into Northern California. One of the most important dates for the influence of Americans is when John Sutter came into Yerba Buena, San Francisco Bay, came up to Sacramento getting permission from the Spanish to form a settlement up near Sacramento. He had big dreams. He had some Kanaka natives from Hawaii. He had some skilled craftsmen he was able to persuade to go with him. Started with a small settlement, built a huge fort, 150 by 500 feet. Today, one of the most impressive tourist spots in the Sacramento area to visit. They've reconstituted that, and you can see it somewhat as it was functioning in those early days. Now, all of this was a kind of an interesting ebb and flow. The Russians up in Alaska needed grain. The arrival of ships from Russia, from Kamchatka Peninsula, were very uncertain. They were often wrecks, and so they went down into California, established along the coast Fort Ross, and they hoped to be able to have enough grain produced there to meet their needs. They also found sea otters, and they were capturing them and getting those pelts so they could be sent over to Canton, China. I couldn't believe in rereading some of this material that one of those pelts was worth $200. So no wonder they were greedy in trying to get them, and they came down even that far to try to capture them. The whole thing, of course, was a maneuvering for power. At one point, the U.S. naval captain came ashore at Monterey. He had wrong intelligence. He told them that he was seizing the country and that station for the United States. They ran down the Mexican flag, ran up the American flag. Then later he heard that that was not his order. He apologized. They had to run down the American flag, put back up the Mexican flag, and he had to not only apologize, but he was really afraid that it might mean he'd be driven out of the U.S. Navy. It didn't happen, but he was really in disgrace for a while. The big date that is memorable, and all the school kids look forward to that celebration in California history, the Bear Flag Revolt, when the little group of opportunists staged a revolt and ran up the Bear Flag. They didn't have authority to run up the American flag. And so today, the California flag has a bear on it. And so when you go to any state building in California, you see the American flag and you see the California Bear Flag. The biggest influence, of course, was gold. It had been discovered in the San Fernando Valley in 1842, but not too much was discovered there. A person could work all day and make $2, but that kind of petered out, and so then there was a little awareness there probably might be gold around Sacramento, but not until in the mill trace up there in the mill did they find nuggets, and then the news circulated. Started the greatest migration into the gold country that any country had had, and it was an international group that came. I wish I could tell you good stories about the fact that the Lutherans were alert. Not too many denominations had people coming along with those miners. One of the reasons was that in the main, they were a rather mobile group. They'd come to one area, there'd be a rich strike. If they ruined that and gold was panned out, they had a rumor there was somewhere else, they'd all pack up and leave. Some gold camps were pretty permanent, but in the main, there was a lot of mobility. One of the most fascinating persons in all that time was a fellow who came into the gold company having come out from Wisconsin. He was one of the many Norwegians that came out. According to records, there's one little place up in the Sierras where there's supposed to have been 3,000 Norwegians up there prospecting for gold. This man's name was John Thompson, and he had become a legend in the whole Sierra history. Every time I read about him for many, many years, and I could read a lot because a lot is written about him, I was always curious, was it possible that John Thompson was a Lutheran? And so some months ago, having again checked on his birthplace, I wrote a letter back to Tinn in Telemark, Norway, to the Lutheran pastor, and I asked, is it possible that John Thompson, who was recorded as having been born as John Torstensen Rue in Tinn in Telemark, was a Lutheran? We got an interesting package of mail back from there in which they gave us the information that absolutely he was. He was baptized there in what at that time was one of the Stavkirk, one of those strange wooden churches. They gave the date of his birth and of his baptism, and they said that he had been baptized on May 24th, 1827, and it was in the old Ostra Stav Church. And that his father died, and he and his mother came to America with a group from that community. They came to New York, came across the Erie Canal by lake up to Chicago, and then they moved up down into Fox River, which is not far from Chicago. Stayed there for a while, moved over to a place in Iowa, and there he stayed with his mother until she died. The other interesting thing is, have any of you ever heard of the Haugians, that movement within the Lutheran Church? Strong, devotional, evangelical movement, the result of this Lutheran layman who had a Christian experience, a very powerful faith, was able to witness to his faith and did some fine writing. And he developed a following. He went about speaking, holding meetings in homes, encouraging people to trust in Christ, and to pray for guidance. And this group that John Thompson was from had been Haugian. And when they came to America, John's mother wrote back that he was working for a Haugian lay preacher and helping him. When his mother died, he moved up to Wisconsin. And there he joined his brother. His brother was a part of a Norwegian little settlement, and they had a church that they had built, and it was called Old Muskego. Have any of you heard of Old Muskego?
Muskegon.
Yeah, Muskego. Not Muskegon, Muskego. Well, if you go to St. Paul and go to Luther Seminary, you can ask to be shown the Old Muskego Church, because it became apparent later that this historic building was probably the very first one constructed by Norwegian Lutherans, and here this John Thompson had gone there. He came out to look for gold along with a half-brother, and he had no luck, but he began to be active in farming and ranching, cutting wood, and then he read a story in the paper that changed his life. It was an advertisement. Up at what is now Placerville was a gold camp called Hangtown. It had that name for an interesting reason. People tried to jump somebody's claim. When that happened, or if anybody was so foolish to try to steal somebody's gold poke, they would be given a summary trial, and as very often was said, you'll get a fair trial before you're hung. But so many people were hung in Hangtown that according to tradition, they left the rope over the branch of a big tree in the center of Hangtown. So you have a feeling of what kind of a community it was. Pretty rough. A lot of saloons, miners. The trouble was that when winter came, there was no way to get messages, mail, or any kind of exchange of packages across the Sierras to Virginia City or Genoa, Nevada, in the Carson Valley. And yet there were a lot of people over there that wanted mail, and the people here wanted to send messages over there, for Virginia City had become a very, very successful mining community. That was where some of the rich loads of silver and gold were. So the postmaster at Hangtown advertised in the Sacramento paper, wanted someone to take the mail from Placerville to Genoa, Nevada. It wasn't Nevada. All of that was California, all the way to the foothills of the Rockies. And as John Thompson read this, he began to remember that as a little lad in Norway, snow didn't bother people. They rode on snowshoes, which is what they called what we call skis. And so he decided it might be interesting to try it. So he made himself a pair of skis, rather long, a little wider than we know as skis today. He took them up to Placerville where there was snow, and he started to practice. And after a week of training, he felt he was ready. So he took his skis, and he also carried a long pole, about 10 feet long, just a long rod. And he went to the postmaster and said, I'm ready to do it. And the postmaster said, what do you mean? He said, I'll take it over on these snowshoes. And the postmaster looked at him, and he really thought it wouldn't work. But he said, no, come on, I'll show you. So he showed him he could navigate on snow. And so he said, I'm ready to go. And they made a big pack for his back, like a big backpack, made out of leather with a big top to it so it could be strapped down. And so he got ready to take the first trip across the mail, across the Sierras with the mail, from Hangtown up over to Genoa. The gamblers in the town, hearing about it, wanted to take odds that he'd never make it. But nobody would bet that he would. They all thought when spring thaw came, they'd find the body of this Norwegian. Well, were they surprised? He left, and 5 days later, he was back with the mail from Genoa. In 3 days, he had made it up and down to Genoa. In 2 days, he made it back, because it was a lot more of a glide and a slope coming back. Now, there is no record that any of the time he was there, he had the opportunity to be a part of any worshiping congregation, certainly no Lutheran church. But today, we now are beginning to be aware that this man who was called Holy John by everybody that knew him, because he was a man of fine reputation, he didn't smoke or drink, he kept himself in fine condition, and for 20 years he carried mail over the Sierras, and then when the Transcontinental Railroad came through, he would go on the railroad and get off and then take the mail up some deserted and forlorn canyon up to the mining camps in that area. He's a fascinating person. I have a few copies here of the Reader's Digest article that called him Snowshoe Thompson, the Paul Bunyan of the High Sierras. And he now is a fellow that we're beginning to call one of the early heroes of the Lutheran Church. Now, he's typical of some of those who live in communities where there was no Lutheran Church. Sometimes there were other congregations, and a little doubt that people became a part of those. But this is Snowshoe Thompson, one of the people that we really can say is one of the early giants. Back into the time of that early history, you all know that after a number of years, the Russians sold their colony at Fort Ross, and John Sutter bought it for $30,000. He is supposed to pay $5,000 one year, $5,000 the next, and then the third year he was forth to pay $10,000. He was supposed to pay that not in cash, but in products. He was supposed to raise grain and see that it got over to the port so it'd be taken up to the Russians. And that's part of the story of Sutter and Sutter's Mill. But when the Gold Rush people came over and the immigrant trains came over, they did find a warm welcome at Sutter's Fort. He was very free in giving them supplies, giving them materials, and then helping them set up, because as a trader, he wanted all that he could do to do it. Now, enough of this quick background. What is the real pattern of the Lutheran Church getting established in the Southwest? Very slowly. There weren't too many that came out at the very beginning. Records seem to indicate that the first pastor who came out came to San Francisco, and it's thought he came around 1849. Who was he? Johann Friedrich Mooshacker. Pretty impressive name, isn't it? Well, he was an interesting fella. Ev and I happened to be in San Francisco at that church, which originally was the old German Evangelical Lutheran Church, and later became known as St. Mark's Lutheran Church. There was a shadowy figure in history that we didn't know anything about. And one day, while I was pastor there, a letter came from Frankfurt, Germany. In it was a picture of Pastor Mooshacker and his wife. And here it was sent to us by one of his descendants, who had been fascinated about this man who had gone to America and had gone to California and who had written back to his family back in a little town, Benzigerode, that was in the East Zone, which soon will become a part of United Germany on the 2nd of October. He had gone to the University of Göttingen in Goslar. He was studying there and studying theology. This was during a time in the 1840s when there was a real student unrest and a student desire for freedom and democracy. But under the Prussian government, that was revolutionary doctrine. And there's an interesting thing in the records of the University of Goslar, the University of Göttingen at Goslar. Göttingen was picked up by the campus police, along with some other people, not for revolutionary conduct, but for disorderly conduct. They were up apparently in Mooshacker's room, and they had sent out for more beverage. Beer it was. And according to the woman who had young woman who had brought up the beverage. She had been treated unkindly and improperly. And one of them had even struck her. So she had reported, the campus police came in, and these students were put in student jail for a couple of days. Then they had a hearing. But in the hearing, Moose Hockey was cleared completely. And she said it was one of the other students, and so Moose Hockey was not dismissed from the university. However, before long, a report came to them that news of their activity to work for freedom had been out, and Moose Hockey was told, run for your life. So he took off, made it up to Holland, and then was able to come to New York, and when there, he got involved with the Lutheran Church, served a congregation in northern New Jersey, and when the news of the gold rush in California came, he volunteered to go as a pastor, and that's why he got to California. Out in California, he met a young woman from Bremen. He married her. They had three children. One of them died very young. Two others lived a while. One of them died. And he stayed as pastor of that church for a number of years and then resigned. I went to the cemetery where I knew he had been buried and checked the record and got some of the information about his death. And all of a sudden, we really began to know a little bit more about this person. We have his signature on pastoral acts, and there is some record about that. The other churches sprang up throughout the West in Sacramento, Los Angeles, San Diego, San Bernardino, later in Santa Barbara, around the Bay Area. But Lutherans really didn't send out pastors and missionaries. Fact is, one of the presidents of Synod later on talked about the fact that when churches wanted pastors to lead them, at first they had to turn to older pastors who had come out west for their health. And then their health improved. And then they were able to take churches, and some of them lived 10, 15 years. And so they were some of the early ones. Now, Moose Hockey, and there's a fascinating fellow that came out from Concordia Seminary. His name was Jacob Bueller. And he became the second pastor of the German church in San Francisco. He's really a very capable leader. He was a very warm person. He was a good pastor. The only thing is, when a historian checked his records and studied at the records of St. Louis at Concordia Historical Institute, they found he was never ordained. He came out as a seminary graduate, but he came out to minister out there, and he was asked to take over the responsibility of the church, and he did so, but there was no one out there to ordain him, and so he began to be a pastor, and nobody challenged it, and he had a long and fruitful ministry. But that's a rather interesting thing, and sometimes we do tease our Missouri brethren that their patriarch pastor in the whole state of California never was ordained. Well, that isn't true about some of the others. I'd like to share a story about one man who had as much influence in California as any of the others. And he's a man by the name of James Prince Beeson. He is a man that we met when we came west in 1943. He was a president of Synod. He had a church also down in Glendale. And the next year, 1944, at the Synod that was held in San Francisco, he was elected to be not part-time president, but full-time president of the United Lutheran Church California Synod. And I just want to share a little bit about Jim Beeson. This is a picture of Jim and his wife, Helga, and I'll pass this around. Just take a look at that as I share a little bit of an story about him. He had been born in St. Paul, Minnesota. His father was a French Huguenot who had married a Swede, and his mother was a very warm, both of them were people of strong faith. They moved from St. Paul to Livingston, Montana. That sound familiar? That's where one of the railroads went. And so towns were growing up all along the railroad. Jim's dad had a store. They went to Livingston, but they found no English church there. So they decided they'd start one. And so Mrs. Beeson, his mother, took little Jimmy, and she went door to door canvassing people to find if anybody would go and attend an English Lutheran church. They got enough people. They were able to get a pastor. They started an English Lutheran church, and they were a part of it for quite a while. About 5 years later, they moved north to Canada, to Winnipeg, Manitoba, where his dad had a store. It was a stronger, growing community. And Jim finished academy there. He went to work as a newspaperman in Minneapolis. He went to college in Pennsylvania, Teal College, and then Muhlenberg, and he went to seminary in Philadelphia. That happened to be my seminary. I went to the seminary registrar a few years ago, and I said, could I see James Beeson's record? This young man was asked by the leaders of the mission program in Minneapolis in the Northwest Synod, would you go out to Williston, North Dakota, and take care of a church whose pastor is sick? And so Jim was licensed to be a pastor after 1 year of seminary. He went to Livingston. They had a parsonage. They were meeting in the Carnegie Library and getting ready to build a church. Jim was lonely. So he wrote to his girl, his sweetheart up in Winnipeg, and she accepted. He took train, went up to Winnipeg, married Helga, brought her back, and they lived one busy year in the parsonage. And then when he was going to go back to Philadelphia, they said, we have a church in Seattle that needs a pastor. So Jim and his wife and the twins went to Seattle. There was a seminary there. He finished seminary. He took another church, did graduate study, got a master's degree. And then a strange thing happened. All of a sudden, he developed an affliction. He had a kind of paralysis on the left side of his face. They tried everything to try to help it, and they couldn't diagnose what the trouble was. Finally, a physician said, maybe if you'd get out of this moist climate into a drier, warm climate, it might help. So Jim was able to get a teaching job down in the Central Valley of California in the town of Taft. So they moved down to Taft. He taught school for a couple years. Then he got a job teaching at Glendale Junior College, and they moved down to Glendale. The strangest thing that happened there is this. He is a powerful personality, but I couldn't believe what he did with his English debating team. You know, he was a new prof, so they gave him all the slower students. So then each English teacher was to develop a public speaking team. Jim's slow pupils quickly became inspired to become outstanding public speakers. They won the competition in their own college, and then they entered the regional competition. And to Jim's pride and joy, they beat the debaters from University of Southern California, from all the Southern California schools, and they even went into regional and national competitions. That so infuriated the four-year universities that after a couple years they passed a regulation. The regional competition shall not be open to students from the two-year schools. Didn't sound very fair to me, did you? Now all the time in the weekends, Jim was preaching. Churches needed supplies, and so he took a church and finally accepted a call to Glendale Lutheran Church. The church was not strong, but under Jim's leadership, the church began to grow. Sunday school grew, more services were held, the building became too small, they built a new building, debt-free, and Jim Beeson's reputation as a leader was made. That's why he was elected in 1942 at Sacramento to be the president of Synod, and he turned that sleepy California Synod right around. At the time he took over, about a half of the churches were so lacking in enthusiasm and so weak that some of them were considering closing up. But Jim inspired that synod to a new sense of mission and evangelism, and he began to start new mission churches. The quick summary is that between 1944 and 1954, 57 new mission churches were started under Dr. James Beesom's leadership. And that was an exciting chapter. The reason, though, beyond that he's important, are really threefold. There was no seminary in the West, there were no homes for the elderly, and there were no Lutheran social service agencies. With tremendous organizing ability, he called out a national staff member in Lutheran social service, and they had a meeting in Los Angeles, and then they had a meeting in San Francisco. They gathered leaders from the different Lutheran bodies and talked about this, and in the Southern California area, they organized a committee to start a Lutheran Welfare Society or social service. They did the same thing in Northern California, and today there are two strong, very, very vital social service agencies in both South and North, and you can go back to the day that Jim Beesom started it. The reason he started a seminary is a bit amusing. If he started about 10 new mission churches a year, and then had to have some other pastors to help pastors that were overworked in churches that were growing, where could he get seminary students? Where could he get graduates? He had to take the train, go back east. He persuaded the presidents of seminaries to let him speak in chapel. And every time he spoke in chapel, he challenged them for the missions in the West. And it was really interesting, the impact that he had. In that book that's going around, there's a little summary of the talk that he gave when he talked in chapel. Usually he got two responses positive from every visit. And so when I joined the Synod in 1945, I was a part of a whole group that he had recruited from Gettysburg Seminary and from Springfield and Chicago and Northwestern Seminary. All of them had come out to help. This went on through 1944, 45, 46, 47, and then in 1947, something happened. The war was about over, and the churches in the Midwest were going to be building missions, and they gave a rule to the seminary president. Don't you let Jim Beesom speak in chapel. We need every graduate we have. And so poor Jim was without a supply of pastors. Now there's only one possibility for us. We had to start a seminary. And we only had about 50 churches in the California Synod, and there were about 24 up in the Pacific Northwest. But at the San Diego Convention, motion was passed and seconded to start a seminary. He called a committee from the two, and in 1952, classes were opened, and the school began with about 24 students. Today, that seminary has graduated 500 graduates, and those graduates are serving all throughout the West. The story of the campus is worth a moment, and I think you might find it as unbelievable as we did. Ev and I had gone back to Berkeley, and it was in Berkeley a seminary was to be started. By this time, Berkeley was a completely built-up community. There were about 20 vacant lots in town, but most of those were on the steep side of hills. And so one of the seminary board members and I were told, find a place for a seminary. For a year and a half, we searched. We worked, we prayed, we looked at every possible property. And then here is the miracle that took place. A real estate friend took us to one way up on the top of the hill overlooking the Golden Gate Bridge. On the other side of the property is Tilden Regional Park. And this property was just lovely, a beautiful home there that would cost $250,000 in 1950 to build. We met the owner, and the board came and looked at it, and they inspected it, and they finally said, it's superb, but it doesn't have enough room. We're going to have to go out in the open country and buy land and build a seminary. So they asked me to go tell the owner of this estate, Mrs. Dobbins. Mrs. Hugh Dobbins, her husband, was a retired Presbyterian pastor, and he had passed on a few years before, and she wanted to move from this big house. So I was telling her that the seminary board really liked her property, but it was too small. Her daughter-in-law quickly observed, but mother, the owners right up the hill, the Clarks, have just decided to sell their place. And Mrs. Dobbins quickly said, oh, but our place is much nicer than theirs. And I'm enough a student of psychology to doubt her. I thought she was thinking, well, if you're going to buy one or the other, let's not let them build that, buy that. So within an hour, I was up taking a peek at it, and both were beautiful estates. The end of it is that about 8 months later, we were able to buy two estates with two gorgeous homes on it, 8 acres of land, the top of overlooking the bay, right at the edge of Berkeley. The price for that, $144,000. Today, I don't think you could touch it for $2 million. And today, it is the place where the two buildings are used, where we have a dormitory. We've converted the six-car garage into faculty offices. We have a library that is now a classroom and administration building, and a lovely big chapel. So today, that's the campus. Now, Jim Beeson is the one that made it possible, and we pay tribute to Jim as a giant who really did it. The other thing he did, he knew that we needed a home for the aged, and there was suddenly a property that they found in Alhambra. He put it together, but they had to have a deposit on it right away. $25,000 had to be put down on it. What did Jim do? He went to his bank. He took a loan on their own private home. He took $25,000. He put it down on this estate in Alhambra. And then about a month later at the Synod Convention, he got them to approve the purchase and take out a loan to buy the property. Today, if you look in the back of that book, you'll find a picture of California Lutheran homes, and inside the back cover, the seven homes in Southern California that are part of California Lutheran homes. So I like to pay tribute to him when I talk about giants of the Lutheran faith, because without Jim Beeson, Lutheranism in California would not be as strong as it has become. There's a couple of rather unusual stories in Arizona. In Arizona, it was difficult to make any impact into the Indians. The Indians didn't welcome too much Christian ministers, but one of them who went down into the area where the Apaches were became acquainted with them, cultivated them, and especially he became quite friendly with the Apache chief. And periodically he would visit this old chief and chat with him. There hadn't really been any baptisms, but he was doing the basic cultivation and getting to know them and their culture. He had a strange experience on one of his visits. He asked to see the chief, and all he got were evasive answers. Nobody would say anything about the chief. All that he learned was the chief wasn't there. Finally, he put two and two together, and he realized that what he had now come upon was the case where, according to Indian custom, when an older person comes to that age where they're not well and not going to get better, they're taken out into the forest and just left to quietly die through exposure. And this pastor was really touched by this, and he was also upset. And he felt that he absolutely had to try to find this chief. So he talked to his wife, and then he prayed. I don't know what he did. Maybe he put himself in the place of those who were going to find a place in the forest. He went out and searched and found the chief while he was yet alive. He took the chief back to his home. He nursed him, his wife cared for him, and he got strong again. And then there came the day that the pastor took the chief back to his people, and the chief again assumed leadership, and later on, you can write the rest of the story. He was baptized. He brought the rest of his people into the church. And if you go down into Arizona today, you'll find that a great many of the Apaches are Lutheran. Fact is, while I was in San Francisco, I remember one day that a fellow came asking for some help. And he was an Apache. He said he was a Lutheran. And we helped him enough that he could get back to his people. And that's a part of the story. There is another one which is a very lovely story. There was a layman who also was an Apache. And the mission group that went there was the Wisconsin Synod. His name was Alcase. And I'm just charmed by this little short story. In 1893, Alcase was already a mature man when the missionaries of the Lutheran Church came to the White River area. This was right after Geronimo had surrendered, and the Apaches had not really liked Geronimo's activities, but they didn't like the fact they were no longer in control. This Alcase realized that they had to accommodate to white people and white ways to survive. He liked the missionaries, he felt they were sincere, and he went for instruction, he attended classes, he learned their religion, their medicine, and their cash economy. He was one of the first Apaches to be baptized, and he became one of the members of one of the earliest Lutheran churches in Arizona. When the first Lutheran building there was to be dedicated, Alcase had become the president, chief of his tribe, and the equivalent of the congregation's president. He was the one that was given the task of having the key and each week opening the church door and welcoming the congregation inside. He used every opportunity he had to help his people. And today, as a result of all that, White River has the Alcase Medical Center, the Alcase School, and the Alcase Lumber Company. But what I like best is this very moving story at the end of his life. The depth of his spiritual commitment showed itself most dramatically in death. As the shades of night began to close, the aged chief asked for an old cloth hidden away among his personal possessions. When he unfolded the faded material, there, to everyone's surprise, was the key which he had used to open the church door many years before. Clutching that key, Alcase sighed his last. The symbolism was obvious. As the Church of Christ had been the key to a meaningful existence in this life, so Alcase trusted the same key would open his way into the life to come. So those are stories of two Apaches. Who are some of the others that have been important in the Lutheran Church? Did any of you ever hear of Admiral Nimitz? Great naval commander? Well, I can't say that he was an active member of any church. But while we were in Berkeley, all the churches banded together on one Sunday afternoon. They surveyed the whole community. And all the churches got back the cards telling of people of their persuasion who were living in this. And one of the names that came back was Admiral Chester Nimitz. And on it was the word Lutheran. Well, I decided the least I could do would be go out and make a pastoral call. So one day I made an appointment and I went out to see Admiral Nimitz. He lived at 512 Arlington on the west side of the street. His wife welcomed me at the door and she said, well, the Admiral's around back pitching horseshoes. So I went around the house and in the back I found the Admiral pitching horseshoes. He was very kind. He welcomed me. And of course, the only thing I could do was offer to play with him. Well, I lost two games because the Admiral pitched a good game of horseshoes. And as we pitched, he told his story. He grew up in a little German settlement in Texas. He had been a part of the congregation there. He was able to enter the Naval Academy, and then he moved on up, as you know. He spent all his life traveling with the Navy. He'd go to naval services in the chapel at the base, and he told one interesting story. At one point, he said, back east, he said, I met an Episcopal priest who was very, very determined that I should be baptized. So he said, I wrote back to my hometown, to my church, and I got a proper certificate telling that priest that I was baptized, and I showed it to him. He said, after that, he let me alone. But the Admiral was a fine person, very gracious, and a person of faith, but he was typical Navy, and he had spent all his life doing that. I guess one of the other very interesting persons is, have any of you ever heard of the Lawrences, Ernest Lawrence and his brother John? Ernest is known in physics as the man who split the atom. He taught at the University of California. He was very, very active at over there in New Mexico, in Los Alamos. But he had a tremendous influence in the whole field of physics and was really a part of the scientific team that did the experimentation that finally led to the atom bomb. But Ernest was a remarkable person. I recall when in Time magazine they wrote about him that television had only had black and white at that time. And someone had to figure out a way for color television. Ernest Lawrence and his wife went down to La Jolla, Southern California, to relax. And according to the report in Time magazine, he spent some time resting on the beach and trying to figure ways that there could be a color television too. Well, in a couple of days, he figured three ways that you could have a color tube. And he patented it. And then later, he sold the rights to produce his patented color TV tube, probably to the firm that sold you yours. And if you have a Sony, you have a Ernest Lawrence created color television tube by the pattern that he worked out himself. He also had a brother, John, who was a very tremendous person in medicine, and I had the opportunity to meet them when their mother became a part of our congregation in Berkeley. And that was a rare thing, to make a visit one day to see their father, who was ill. By this time he was blind and bedfast, and to make a call on Mrs. Lawrence and to see her husband and to meet Ernest and John. I really, as I look back, I don't know any other single Lutheran family who have produced two outstanding children as John and Ernest Lawrence and their impact in the whole society. The Lutheran Church today is strong in the Southwest. I remember in Phoenix when we only had two Lutheran churches, one Missouri and one non-Missouri, Grace. Today, if you go down into the Phoenix area, there are over 50 churches. If you go to Tucson, there are probably 14. Up in Nevada, a whole cluster of churches around Las Vegas, another cluster up around Reno. Northern California, Northern Nevada Synod alone has 287 churches. And today there are certainly in the Southwest a very, very large number. In 1946 and 7, I was asked to make a study of the Lutheran Church and what was going to happen and what should happen in missions. And I think you might be interested. I was amused at what I had written. I'd like to read just a paragraph, because I had the task of speaking to all the mission directors of the National Lutheran Council, the Swedes, the Danes, the Finns, the Norwegians, and the Germans, as they met in Toledo, Ohio. And as I concluded this, I had to do something to tell them the sudden bursting of population in California, especially at the end of the war. Remember, during the war, home builders couldn't get any materials. Everything was held for the military needs. But when the war was over, there was a building boom in California and the Southwest like you could hardly imagine. And so I had to challenge them. And this is the way I concluded. In California today, some communities are literally springing up. Especially is this true in the Los Angeles area, but the Bay Area is receiving its share of growth. The new home communities will follow the general trend of this one community we surveyed. Californians will make up about half of the residents of those planned towns, and many of the newcomers will prove to be from north central and northwestern states. Today, Los Angeles is more than ever a suburb of a growing nation. Distance means little anymore. The final decision facing the Lutheran Church concerning Southern California, this was 1947. Will tomorrow be too late? In these communities, the answer is simply yes. Certain areas need churches within a year. Zoning ordinances in these planned communities restrict the location of churches to a limited area, usually adjacent to the business and shopping area. The Lutheran Mission Church must be checked in on the blueprint along with a supermarket, the movie and the shopping center, or the Lutheran Church will be out. In certain communities, it is a now or never proposition. Walnut or orange groves today, community tomorrow. Mission work in California today takes a strange and wonderful faith, for many communities soon to grow may never have any church unless a church is built with the homes. The Lutheran mission record of the last decade is a little short of miraculous. The needs of California today demand more mission miracles. The Savior commanded us to go, teach, and baptize. What will our answer be? Well, I can report that after that speech, they shifted, they tell me, $2 million of mission money. They poured in young pastors into California and Arizona, and they built 20, 25 mission churches a year, and they increased the pace. And that's a part of the story of the mission expansion in the West. Who are these giants? Well, let me trace the men and the women who came. The faithful men and women who taught Sunday school, gave their funds to build churches, took their place in the congregations, and helped build those churches. And it was a tremendously exciting story. And the pastors who came, many of them left their family 2,000, 3,000 miles away, and they serve faithfully and creatively. And that's the story. I just am happy to have had an opportunity to share about the Mission Church of the West and the giants that made it possible. Do you have any question about that? Or would you like to share any comment? Were you a part of any of that? Or were any of your immediate relatives in any of those mission churches? You were in other areas, huh? Were any of you in any church in California or Arizona?
My brother was a mission pastor in Oregon.
Was he? What part?
Seaside, Oregon.
Seaside.
He
Oh, yeah. Now, who was that?
Paul.
Oh, I knew Paul.
Did you?
Yeah, and then the one that followed Paul was a member of our church in Berkeley that came up there. You know who it was? I forget. It was Barbalo, Bob Barbalo. He followed Paul. It's time to quit, so I say thank you so much. It's good to be together and share this material.